Good afternoon, and welcome to the final broadcast of the 2007 season of Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator for the Fireside Chats. As our listeners may know, the SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's collections are free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate and independent of the SEC and receive no government funding. We thank ASECA, the Association of SEC Alumni, Inc., and Pfizer, Inc., for their generous sponsorship of the entire 2007 Fireside Chat season. Their support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Today's Fireside Chat looks at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and specifically Section 404, which states that management must attest to the fact that there are internal controls and that an auditor must attest to the adequacy of those controls. Last March, in our first Fireside Chat of the season, which focused on Congress and the SEC, Dean Shahinian, one of our panelists, expressed surprise that SOX and Section 404 still stir up controversy. In July, at a gathering on the fifth anniversary of the signing of the Act, former Congressman Michael Oxley noted that Sarbanes-Oxley continues to be blamed for just about everything. And visitors to the virtual museum and archive this month can listen to The Sarbanes-Oxley Blues, written and performed by Dave Maney. Well worth the visit for that opportunity alone. From the historic perspective, I can attest that there are not many legislative acts that have inspired musical responses. To discuss why the Sarbanes-Oxley Act might make people blue, I'm delighted to welcome Kurt Schacht, Managing Director of the CFA Institute Center for Financial Market Integrity, and Herbert Wander, partner in the Chicago office of Katten Muchin Rosenman LLP. Herb is also a founding member of the Society's Board of Advisors. The remarks of our guests today are solely their own and are not representative of the Society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. Kurt and Herb, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our focus today is, of course, Section 404 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. That gives us the when, at least, but we're still missing the who, what, and why. Starting with what, in general terms, what does Section 404 require?
Well, as you alluded to in your opening comments, Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 was enacted in response to what was really a growing crisis in market confidence, I think exemplified by both Enron and certainly WorldCom. What SOX 404 is, it's been described as really the heart and soul of Sarbanes-Oxley. It's the portion of SOX that's really designed to create a reasonable assurance for users of financial statements, including investors, that the financial reports are free from any material error. And that's, in a nutshell, what SOX 404 is all about.
And on its face, who does it apply to?
Well, it would apply to essentially companies that are registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, in other words, publicly held companies.
You already alluded to the why, that is, that Congress seems to have been reacting to the Enron and WorldCom situations, perhaps, and given us some indication of what it was trying to achieve. I do have a question that relates to something that came up in the last Fireside Chat last month, having to do with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That is, what exactly is the relationship between Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley and the FCPA? How are they the same? How are they different?
Well, they're not really that different. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was designed to, if you'll recall, was passed, I think, in 1977, to stop the so-called foreign bribery and paying political payments and payments under the table. But it also included a provision that required publicly held companies to have internal controls that are designed to provide a reasonable basis for thinking that the financial statements were accurate and reflected all the transactions that the company entered into. but it was not self-enforcing, and it was just strictly a law on the books. And frankly, in preparing for this fireside chat, I really couldn't think of, I didn't do any research, but I couldn't think of anybody who has really violated the books and records in, of not having internal controls from 1977 on through 2002. And about 10 years prior to 2002, a provision was added to the financial institutions that are regulated by the federal government that required them to have their accounting firm attest to their internal controls. Were their internal controls adequate enough to give them a reasonable basis for believing that their financial statements were sound and accurate? But that never had to be published, and the standards by which the accountants provided that attestation were based on the AICPA rules. And it was not that difficult to comply with that section, so that when Congress passed SOX, it included a provision that said, well, we'll have internal controls attested to by your outside auditing firm, similar to what we did for the financial institutions. And I think you'll see from the Senate report that they thought that would not add much in terms of cost, and that every audit included an audit of internal controls. But they neglected to really think about the Pandora's box they opened by establishing also the PCAOB as part of SOX, which now became the regulating entity for accounting firms. They were no longer going to be self-regulated, but regulated by, in effect, a government body. And they were the ones who adopted the standards for accounting firms to do the internal control attestation.
That's a wonderful summary. I'm not much of an expert in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but it's continually the thing that people in discussing Sarbanes-Oxley feel was given really short shrift, that there was the requirement to have internal controls in place, and that as a factual matter, very little attention was being paid to that by both the management and the auditor in practice, and that was one of the things that led to the problems we had in 2001, 2002, and really the genesis for Sarbanes-Oxley.
There is a theory afoot that Congress really didn't intend to change much, but merely wanted to look as though it were doing something for purposes of building investor confidence. Do you think there's any credence to that conspiracy theory?
No, I think it's a combination that they had to act because the market was constantly falling dramatically every day, primarily after WorldCom. And the lack of confidence, as Kurt said, was extremely important. Congress is a political animal, and they stepped in. There's debates on whether they really studied the subject or not, but the fact is they stepped in and enacted a whole panoply of laws. Not only did they establish the PCAOB, but they made further regulation of audit committees for publicly held companies, prevented loans to executive officers, have a clawback provision for profits made by the CEO and the CFO from faulty financial statements caused by improper conduct. So there were a lot of different provisions in it, but the one that I think everyone has focused on the most is Section 404 and the internal audit.
Yeah, I would agree. I think any suggestion that they really didn't intend much just really glosses over the facts and circumstances of the time. It was a very real crisis. It was something that it's hard to envision that they would want to take half measures given what was going on back in those times. So it was a very comprehensive package, as Herb has pointed out. It was reviewed and it was implemented through that normal congressional process, but it was certainly an expedited process, which I think is another reflection of how important people thought it was to get something done. I think the question continues to remain that there's a lot of people that feel that this was an overreaction to the Enron area and that there really wasn't much attention paid specifically to the provisions of Section 404, and in fact, it wasn't. You know, there's not much legislative history in terms of that being discussed. But I think what happened was that people were thinking that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was actually working, and didn't really understand the degree to which controls had fallen by the wayside in terms of their being reviewed and by both management and outside audit. So the level of the repair that was needed, I think, was greatly underestimated. And I think it was certainly not something that they would realize at the time, but the amount of auditor zeal that went into looking at internal controls post-Enron and post-Arthur Andersen, I think, really changed the dynamic quite dramatically.
Well, I think really, in addition to that, the PCAOB adopted what was called AS2, Accounting Standard Number 2, which was how the auditors were supposed to conduct the attestation for the internal control review and issue their report. And I think by virtue of the changes made just from AS2 to the changes they made to AS5, which was adopted this year, I think everyone would recognize, at least I think most people would agree, that AS2 was very heavy-handed, very complicated, very lengthy, too prescriptive. And as a result of that combination with, as Kurt said, the accountants now being extremely cautious because of the liability concerns, and the PCAOB process of inspecting accounting firms was created really what was a perfect storm, so that everybody went out, and some companies will tell you that they identified, you know, 10,000, 20,000 key accounts. And, you know, when you sort of look back at that time, I think even those who are strongly in favor of the 404 provisions would agree that, you know, that was just going off the cliff.
I suspect that this next question is either unanswerable or self-answering, but does legislative history, your own analysis or whatever, give us any insight into what kind of controls the poster children, that is Enron and WorldCom, actually lacked, or given us any sense that if controls had been in place, things would have turned out differently?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think at WorldCom, you had management override, which is something that internal controls are very concerned with, but it's very difficult under the best of circumstances to detect senior management override, which is what happened. So would it have been caught? I don't know, but there's a chance it wouldn't have been caught because management override is very difficult to tackle. One of the other things in 404's favor is that not only do you want to produce accurate financial statements, but you want to find out if you're not on a more timely basis. And so you perhaps would have caught Enron or maybe WorldCom earlier than you did by virtue of the fact that you now have the 404 attestation. But, Kurt, would you agree, or do you have a different sort of feeling on that?
I agree. Management override is really one of the key aspects of what was missing. I think the other thing that would probably have changed quite significantly had this been in place is the level of auditor independence and whether or not auditors were actually looking at these things as an independent matter as opposed to being more of a collegial discussion with management. I think that's changed quite dramatically. But as you say, very difficult to be a guess at this point to know whether things would have turned out differently. We like to think that stronger controls would have prevented the Skilling, the Lay, Fastow, Ebbers activities, that maybe some of the whistleblower protections would have brought people forward maybe sooner than they would have otherwise. But it's difficult to guess what might have happened.
What do you think about the state of the art with respect to the guidance that has come from the SEC and the PCAOB in recent months? Is there now enough guidance for people to feel relatively comfortable that they know what's expected?
I think most people are cautiously optimistic, if that's a good term, in terms of the fact that AS5 is a much simplified version. AS5 also, I think, really mandates a top-down approach, a risk-based approach, so that you pick out the biggest risks and make sure those are covered by your internal controls rather than look at 20,000 separate key accounts. And so I think that, and it's much simplified. I still think it's a little heavy-handed in the sense that they don't give the auditing firms enough judgment, room for judgment, which I think is one of the very serious problems here. And if you have to make a judgment decision, the auditors are going to be on the, you know, the very cautious side. I think they could have spoken up there. I do think AS5 could have chosen a better definition of materiality. I don't think the definition is essentially changed from that of AS2. But it is an improvement. I don't think that they talk about scalability for smaller public companies, but no one knows what that means. It's still not very well fleshed out, and so we'll have to see when the smaller public companies start becoming subject to 404 in the coming years. But it is an improvement. And then the SEC adopted this management standard, which was lacking prior to that time. Management had no standard, so by default, the accounting standard became management standard. I think the SEC's standard is readable. I think it is simplified, and hopefully it will produce more efficient and accurate audits. It's what we're looking for.
I agree with all that. I would just add that there's actually some specific mention in AS5 that about how smaller firms can actually tailor their internal control structure to fit those principles. So I think that's good. You know, on the management side, the information that's coming down from the SEC in terms of how you create that framework and now being able to use some risk-based judgment in terms of what controls are important and what the most risky areas are, and then carrying through to the management's assessment of those controls, allowing them to really focus and be more thorough on the riskier areas and spend less time and less money, hopefully, on looking at the minor areas, minor controls of the company. And I it'll be interesting to see how this plays through in its first cycle, but the hope is, and I think the expectation is, that this will be a significant improvement for those that are already online as well as those that are about to come online for their SOX reviews.
And it still depends on a lot on how the accounting firms will implement it, and how the PCAOB inspections of the accounting firms will come out. The PCAOB has made it one of its four principal points that they will have inspections that look to make sure the accounting firms are efficient and effective in their audits of 404. But that remains to be seen.
Well, I think I have definitely heard you saying here that small issuers are not exempt, given once they have registered under the 34 Act, that there is a scalability notion. How about foreign issuers? Are they treated the same way as domestic issuers?
Well, again, I think all U.S. filers are going to be treated the same. There's some differences in terms of when they have to comply with the management report piece and the outside audit piece, whether it's a foreign filer or a small firm or an IPO. But I think at the end of the day, everybody that's a U.S. filer is required to operate under the same framework.
That's essentially the case. Eventually, everybody who is publicly held in the U.S. will be subject to it.
Now, bearing down a bit more specifically on the effect of Sarbanes-Oxley on foreign issuers, one reads that SOX is driving them or keeping them away from offerings in this country. Is the evidence on that anything more than anecdotal?
Well, everybody who has a computer nowadays writes an article, and unfortunately most of them are peer-reviewed, and and they get picked up, and so it's, I think it's very hard to tell whether it's kept people from coming to the United States. I think there are a whole host of factors that you'd have to consider. Other markets are getting better. Money's available in other places. But I think one would conclude that it's not a factor that gets people to come here. I think it's really a factor that probably does hurt, but the extent that it does hurt, I don't know if anybody's really measured accurately.
Well, we've certainly heard lots about this, both whether IPOs have been affected as well as whether foreign listings have been affected, either initiating or maintaining their listing in this country. We think that to suggest that SOX in and of itself is the leading culprit is sort of a stretch of the facts. Herb mentioned there's all sorts of reasons as to why this dynamic is where it is. We have the global competition going on, the globalization of markets, generally speaking. We have home country bias. We have underwriting costs. And I think certainly regulatory complexity is an issue. But whether, you know, the piece of regulatory complexity related to Sarbanes-Oxley, whether that's the principal cause, I think is really a suspect argument. There have been several studies recently that refute whether Sarbanes-Oxley or really anything that's endemic to the U.S. markets are at work, that there's sort of natural consequences of the dispersion of capital that's going on in global marketplaces. The wonderful article this weekend in the New York Times magazine by a guy by the name of Daniel Gross. Everybody wants their own Wall Street. They see the prosperity here. They want that prosperity. And for so many, many years, the competitive position of our markets have really dominated. That dominance has been deep and it's been long. And other people see that, and it's only natural in a global environment that gap is going to narrow over time. And I think that's a lot of what's happening. There was an interesting article beginning of the year looking at the amount of delisting of foreign companies in the Wall Street Journal, and they were looking at it from the year 2000 through January of 2007. And the percentages of foreign delistings were actually lower in the United States, according to that article, than any other of the markets, the developed markets, whether you're looking at Germany, even the UK, which is always pointed to as where all of these listings are going, lost ground in terms of foreign listings. So I think that casts some concern over whether and to what extent Sarbanes-Oxley has really had that kind of impact.
I think two other factors are important. One is I think foreigners do not like our litigious atmosphere here. And I do think that, at least in my own opinion, is a very serious factor. In fact, five law professors have just recently written the SEC to engage in a very detailed study about the effect of litigation on promotion of business, job creation, building the economy. So you have the litigation element, which is very big. And the other one that I've heard, and I don't know how true it is, but I suspect that there is some truth to it, is that foreigners are worried about what happens in the next crash, what laws are we going to pass? And they think we're too quick-triggered in that respect.
And that's interesting because in light of the SEC's move toward easing deregistration for foreign issuers, that would seem to give them a safety valve. That is, if they come into our system, they can get back out if something untoward were to happen, I suppose.
Well, but it's hard to get out. For example, I had a client who company left the United States and they charged us the transfer tax, which was a large amount of money, and they didn't waive that. So, you know, they make enemies when they leave, and they don't like to necessarily leave.
Good. Again, we've recently made it easier for that departure, right? I think there's still some concern and some sensitivity to the fact that there's legacy investors that are left behind that were reliant on the public filings that these companies made, and that there should be some balance with respect to that. But I think we've made it easier.
We've made it easier here, but that doesn't negate the fact that they had to pay England taxes on their deregistering, in effect, in the United States.
And to stick with the foreign theme for just a bit longer, I had read in the not-too-distant past something about the fact, someone making the argument, that it was unnecessary to subject foreign issuers to the requirements of SOX because they were already subject to similar requirements at in their home jurisdictions. Is there anything to that argument?
I personally don't think so. I mean, Kurt and I discussed that prior to the program slightly. For example, Canada specifically has said that we would like management to attest to their internal controls, but the outside auditor does not have to. And I think that's common around the world. And every other country has different listing standards, different cultures, so I really don't think you can compare the two.
Changing tax just a little bit here, I'd like you to pretend that I'm on the board of the smallest issuer that might be affected by Section 404, and then tell me what our compliance program would look like.
That's a loaded question, and remember, we're not giving legal advice here. But I honestly think that the advice you would give a board of directors relative to this issue would be the same, whether it's a small company or a large company, that you would want to give the advice to the audit committee, that you would want to make sure that you had a competent audit committee that was able to understand and ask management the right questions about the design of controls, for example, how they've been implemented, whether in fact the controls are effective, what sort of testing did they do, to explain that, what are some of the most important risk areas of the company, what controls are in place to cover those high risk areas, whether they had any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses, and a full explanation as to why those were uncovered. And also, as we had talked earlier, I think one of the more important questions to ask as a director is, how do you handle the management override issue? What protections do you have in place, and what assurance do you have that those are actually working?
Well, I'm going to elaborate a little bit. If you're really small, I would tell you shouldn't be public. I mean, by really small, I'm talking less than 100 million in market cap, total market cap, not just the non-affiliated shareholders, and those are reasons, legal, regulatory, as well as just the marketplace. You're not going to attract large investors in these companies anymore because they have billions of dollars to invest, and they just don't have the time and the resources to invest in these smaller companies. But once you go public, you have a whole disclosure regimen. The disclosure, you have proxy statements, quarterly statements, including unaudited financial statements. You have a yearly 10-K report with audited financial statements. You have current reports on 8-K. You have to comply with Regulation FD, which limits your kinds of disclosure. You can't tip anybody. And the insiders are going to be subject to Section 16, the insider reporting and short swing profit provisions. And then you're going to have to set up a disclosure committee and an internal disclosure committee to make sure that the procedures are in place to ensure that your controls are working and that your disclosure is right. And then we haven't mentioned the fact that not part of SOX, but what happened at the same time were the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ changed their listing requirements. And so the listing requirements now require you to have a majority of independent directors, so you're going to have quality, experienced, independent directors. You're going to have three committees, an audit committee, as Kurt talked about, but you're also going to have a compensation committee and a nominating committee made up entirely of independent directors. Except for some few exceptions where you're a controlled company. You are going to have codes of ethics. You're going to have hotlines. The insiders are not going to be able to freely trade their shares whenever they want. They're subject to the 33 Act and Rule 144. They're subject to the anti-fraud provisions if they trade on inside information. You're going to have to adopt an insider trading policy, and you're going to have to recapture short swing profits, which are purchases, sales that cause a profit or that take place within 6 months. So you've got that. Then you've got the costs of auditing, legal costs, director fees and their education, D&O insurance costs, experts for the committee. The committees are entitled to hire their own outside experts. You're going to have, and this is one of the things that I say to companies that are thinking of going public, you're going to have experienced staffing. You can't do it with a CFO, for example, who came up through the financial world rather than the accounting world. And there are a great many of those. So you're going to have adequate staffing. And then you're going to have to tell the company, by the way, you're subject to these liabilities under the federal securities laws, both the 33 Act and the 34 Act, as well as, you know, state fiduciary law. So it's a daunting task. Many companies do it, but I think that you will find if you look at the size of IPOs today as versus 7-8 years ago, they're much, much larger companies going public to support the staff and the costs for all this.
I agree with much of that. I would say that we're probably a little bit more optimistic about the benefits of being a public company and the ability to access public capital, and small companies become big companies, and you need to go through that process. There's no doubt about it. It's different being a public company, but it offers the benefits of accessing pretty much, depending on how good your business is and what your prospects are, pretty much unlimited base of capital, which I think is a very attractive thing for a lot of issuers, regardless of their size.
But when your stock price is doing well, that's great. When your stock price isn't, your shareholders don't want you to issue additional stock because of the dilution effect. So you're subject to a market that in many respects you're really not have any control over. So there, I agree, if you need a lot of money and you don't want to over-leverage the company, public markets are a great vehicle. But that's when things are going great. When things aren't going great, it becomes very expensive.
Now, do you think that you've changed your line on this in any regard post-Sarbanes-Oxley? Or is this the same position that you held in the year 2000?
No, I think we advised our clients of all these problems. For example, if you're a small company and you have to file current reports and tell a major material contract, if you're a small company, you know, almost any contract becomes major. And I had clients who decided that they could not take that kind of exposure. They were dealing, for example, with the Giants. And the Giants said, you can't disclose a contract with me, even though it's a big supply contract for the smaller company. So there are whole aspects, competitive aspects, et cetera. I think what has changed, over the last 10 years is that the governance system has changed. People went public 10 years ago, you needed two independent directors, right, Kurt? Mm-hmm. Now you need a majority of independent directors. Assume you've been a founder of a business and you've run the business for 40 years, 30 years, 20 years. You know, that's taking a cold shower. And that's been a change. So I think what it is you have to do is make sure that the client, before it puts its foot in the water, understands the process. And then understands what it's going to be, how it will be affected by this going forward.
No question that being a public company is a complex process. But again, the access to that capital, and the other piece of this, of course, is with that comes the responsibility for investor protections. And these things are not just complex to be complex. They're complex for a reason, and I think that's reflected in a lot of the studies that show the cost of capital in our markets because of a lot of that complexity and because of a lot of that investor protection is actually lower here. So some positive benefits to to that complexity.
Well, and frankly, we also tell people that, you know, once you start taking other people's money, which is, I think, what Kurt would say, you know, you become a keeper of that money for them, and you owe them the disclosure and the ethics and the honesty and the transparency that they're entitled to receive. And if you don't think you can measure up, you shouldn't go public.
Do you think that SOX, though, in and of itself, Section 404, has added on a significant layer of complexity? In terms of being public?
Well, I think really where the difficulty becomes for smaller public companies is I think you're going to find, and I know that based on at least my experience, they're finding it harder and harder to find really qualified accounting staff. You can't do it with a one- or two-person staff. You've really got to have a really qualified staff. Now, if you're in Chicago or New York, the job market is a hell of a lot different than it is if you're in Madison, Wisconsin, or Jim was, you know, small town Jasper, Indiana. You know, how do you get directors to come to Jasper, Indiana? That's a good question.
Refreshments.
Huh?
Refreshments,
well,
I said.
But, you know, if it takes a day for them to travel mm-hmm. each way, that's 2 days, and you have 2 days of meeting. That's a lot.
Definitely.
So you know, you have to look at this from a broader perspective than just the big money centers. And I would caution people that that staffing is very important. I think I have personally seen that most of the material weaknesses, and that's what happens if you don't get a passing grade on your internal audit, is you have a material weakness and you have to describe your material weakness. I think most of the material weaknesses, shouldn't say most, but a large percentage of material weaknesses are caused by the fact that they don't have adequate accounting personnel.
This is very interesting because I was curious about whether 404 compliance was a question of adding people and where they would go on the organizational chart, or whether it was just a question of adding something to existing personnel's job descriptions. And it sounds to me as though you're thinking that, or you're suggesting that maybe there do need to be additional personnel, and at least some of them should be in the accounting department. Is that right?
Yes, by all means.
I think there's a mixed way to approach this. I think it's in both audit firms and investors are very concerned about the level of expertise and the understanding of financial reporting and the complexities that some of these standards bring, particularly Sarbanes-Oxley. And it's a matter of having some experienced assistance, whether you do that through new staff or whether you go out and hire that in terms of a consulting arrangement. And there becomes another issue of cost. But it's clearly important enough and complex enough that there is some concern about the level of expertise, particularly with regard to a lot of these smaller companies that are coming online to go through their first cycle of Sarbanes-Oxley. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And it also becomes more critical as we talk through those two new standards, both the SEC guidance and the PCAOB's AS5, that require a pretty significant ability to understand what the risky areas are, understanding how you would actually formulate an effective control to meet that. And I think that it just sort of raises the bar in terms of the competence and experience that you have to have.
Can you give me an example of an area of risk for some type of company?
In terms of a sort of a standard internal control?
Yes.
Well, there's, I think the two most prominent are that you have to have accurate, complete records of all the transactions that end up making their way onto the financial statements, and that information is accurate, it's complete, and it's protected. So that whole process, as well as a process and policies and procedures in place to make sure that the unauthorized use of assets, company assets, is something that is either detected and or prevented as part of that process. So those are the two that are commonly identified as the types of internal controls that are risk-based.
Thank you.
But let me go dig just a little deeper. Take the area of revenue recognition. When do you recognize it? And that, as we've seen from vast number of restatements was something that was, in fact, generally manipulated. Or, if you have a software contract and you have to provide services to it and you never did and you sort of took the revenue in day one, well, you should have taken it in over the time that you owed them updates on the product that you sold. So revenue recognition is an area that to many companies is very risky. Derivative accounting. Look at everybody has had a problem with derivative accounting. And because the book is 480 pages.
Deferred taxes.
Even we had the problem with these leasehold interests. All the retailers found out they had to restate because, we've been interpreting this wrong for the last 30 years. So those are the areas. And there is a whole study, enterprise risk management, which people are going to, I think, be paying more and more attention to, which covers not simply the accounting, but it covers the whole business area. People are going to have to focus on, what keeps the CEO up, at night. What is he really worried about or she really worried about? One of my clients, we had this discussion, and they had, for example, they had a few large clients. Well, we had the risk factor said the loss of a client could be very material to us. Well, it's a risk. Now, it's not an accounting risk. I mean, we'll know when we lose the account, but how do you protect against that? Well, you give good service, right? You know what the customer is thinking of, and those sorts of things. So it's a whole area of risks that companies have to account for. Changing technology, are you going to make the right bet?
That's the nice thing. It is really a case-by-case analysis now with both the SEC guidance and the AS5 guidance, that there is some risk-based judgment that you don't have to just go through and have every conceivable control in place, because that's what was going to be audited under AS2, that there's really a focus on the most important areas of the company, a top-down look at what are the key areas and what are the key risks. And I think that's there's sort of a blessing and a curse there, right? It gives you the flexibility, but then you have to have the competent and experienced staff in order to actually identify those key areas and the key controls that are necessary.
One of the other areas, with going back to staffing and that risk, one of the areas where I see people getting into difficulty again into the restatements or material weaknesses is they don't have enough analytics once the results are in, and they don't therefore spot problems that are that have occurred. Why am I so far off budget here? Is it just business, or is it somebody's cheating me, somebody on my own staff cheating me? And so you have to have enough staff so that you do that top-down view and what are the key drivers in the business and am I performing the way I should, and if not, why not? Now, WorldCom was the reverse. They were performing so well that they drove AT&T crazy. How can we compete with them?
Yeah. Certainly you've referred to competent in-house staff. Is this also an area where people turn to outside specialists, in addition, of course, to their outside auditors, but to tell them sort of what the state of the art is to which they could be compared and found lacking? Or could someone just try and do whatever they think is reasonable under the circumstances?
I think it'd be very dangerous just to do what you think is reasonable unless you really understand this. So you need professional guidance, whether it be accounting, legal, software, IT. You can't operate sort of saying I think it's reasonable. I don't know whether you agree with that.
I agree, and we talked earlier that this will evolve to the point where we will have a state-of-the-art process that will get developed in terms of how a company would assess, given all the options for internal controls and the potential risks, they will assess what's appropriate for their companies, and perhaps those software programs already exist, but this will continue to evolve and I think get refined, and particularly as the smaller firms go through one or more cycles of 404 that they're going to refine some of these helps in terms of creating the internal structure to be quite useful.
There's a whole cottage industry of compliance that has grown up. So the American entrepreneurial system is working at its best. Their day doesn't go by where I don't get 10 blogs and advertisements for either a seminar or software system, or come to listen and I'll teach you how to do this, that, and the other thing. The problem is that I think much of this is conflicting, isn't very well thought out, and so you really have to be smart enough to sift through and get the best that you can.
I wonder if anyone is yet offering degrees in SOX compliance. If not, it's probably the coming thing. Everything we've been talking about here obviously comes at a price. Are there any, at least somewhat reliable figures out there, how much, on average, companies are spending on 404 compliance?
Well, it's getting more difficult to really do that because now it's, quote, an integrated audit. You get the audit and the SOX together as one. And so the figures that are reported in proxy statements are one figure for both the regular audit and the and SOX. And that just covers what you're spending on your outside auditor. It doesn't include what you're spending in internally, and it doesn't include all the consultants that you've hired. But, you know, the numbers were astronomical the first few years. I think they haven't been as high as that, and we will see whether the new AS5 and the SEC's guidance will, let me put it this way, not reduce the fees, because I think that's a dream world, whether the steep incline of their increases will moderate somewhat. We'll see.
I think that's right, and I think, you know, the observation that Herb and I heard many, many times is the cost of compliance for large firms in terms of its relevance to overall revenues was actually a drop in the bucket in many cases, and that a lot of the larger firms that were consulted on this actually lauded the SOX 404 process, thinking that it was a very important process for them to refine the quality and the accuracy of their financial reporting. So this really does boil down to a cost issue for the small issuer in terms of how it relates to their revenues. And I don't think anybody disagrees with the notion that internal controls are important, that there should be some level of management reporting on those. There should be some level of external oversight. It gets down to a matter of cost. And we're quite optimistic, again, that this new guidance that allows this to be a risk-based, scaled approach for smaller firms is going to at least lower the initial costs of implementation as well as subsequent cycles of Sarbanes-Oxley. So, as Herb says, the cost is never going to go away, and it's never going to be zero, and the question is how quickly these things, how quickly they go up, given the demand on services and so forth.
And then I go back to when I was talking about staffing. If you have good systems in place yourself, the auditors under AS5 now can rely more heavily on your internal audit or on other sources rather than the outside auditor. So you can do things to help yourself if you're an issuer to reduce the costs and make the process more efficient. And that's, again, why you need really good, competent, experienced staff.
Are you aware of anyone who actually is trying to conduct some sort of survey to find out how much is being spent, or is this another area that's mostly anecdotal?
Everybody does. The FEI does.
FEI's just come out with a study not too long ago. They looked at, I think, 200 firms that had at least $6 billion in revenues, and I think the average cost for the SOX compliance was something in a range of $3 million. That's, again, scaling that for the small issuer. I've seen costs anywhere from $300 to $1 million and subsequent declines in succeeding cycles of the examination. So
there is a learning curve?
There's very definitely a learning curve.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies. the accounting firms put out studies, and everybody, again, you have to be a statistician to really understand them.
Well, what do you think your bottom line is, Herb? Are investors better or worse off with 404? And then, Kurt, I'll ask you, of course, the same question.
Well, I would have hoped to see a better model for the smaller public companies, which I think they're, and I know there's some basis for saying that the smaller ones, the audit itself catches most of the problems, and that you don't have to do a separate audit for internal controls. As you grow larger, as you grow more complex, maybe not even larger, but more complex, there's a strong feeling, particularly by the COSO people, that, you know, internal controls are a good business aspect. How do you know that people aren't stealing from you, et cetera, and that you're keeping books at the subsidiary in Hershey, Pennsylvania are accurate? So I would have hoped that there would have been some better scaling and more definitive scaling for the smaller public companies. But we're where we are, and we're going to have to live with it and do the best job we can, and hopefully continue to improve both the regulations and the accounting structure and the company's own internal controls.
I would say that investors have benefited in significant ways with respect to SOX 404 in particular. I think it's revealed a lot of deferred maintenance, as people have called it, from the foreign corrupt practices days, and in terms of getting that internal control structure up to snuff. It's resulted in many restatements that I think are a reflection of how poorly some of these internal controls were designed and maintained. We had something over 1,500 material weaknesses and misstatements just last year in 2006, and they tend to come down in subsequent cycles. So there's a process by which it improves the quality of the financial reporting internal controls, and I think that's a very effective investor protection. We've created the PCAOB. I know Herb might have a different view of the value of the PCAOB, but we now have an independent, fully funded organization that has the enforcement ability to use with respect to the audit community. I think it's increased the independence of audit firms, which is a wonderful thing in terms of investor protection. We've added some whistleblower protections, and I think that it's really primarily refocused both management and the board of directors on the importance of accurate financial reporting like nothing else has in the past.
Have there been any enforcement actions brought for violations of Section 404? That is, you're telling me that it's working. People are doing the restating to reveal things they should have been revealing in the past. But this is a different question.
It's really not that kind of a statute where you have enforcement, unless I guess you have fraud or somebody's lying. What it is you do the audit of internal controls, and if you have a material weakness, then you have to disclose that material weakness in your SEC reports and essentially say, I have this material weakness, it could have the following effects, and here's what I'm doing to remediate the effect. So it's not something where they come back and say, you didn't pass, you go to jail or you get fined. It's just the fact that you haven't passed, and you tell the investing public that you haven't passed, here's why, and here's what I'm doing to change it. So it's not that kind of a statute.
I think that's right. I think its utility as a tool of prosecution has probably been pretty limited. The one noted case is the HealthSouth case, where Richard Scrushy was actually got off. In that circumstance, Yale professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld calls it the corporate O.J. Simpson case. and there has been, you know, 400 to 500 cases under the DOJ's corporate fraud sweep since 2002, and very few of those have the convictions and the pleadings under those cases have really not been. SOX has not been instrumental with respect to those, so that you get the convictions, you get the cases to plead out. So, you know, it's not been particularly necessary in terms of prosecuting corporate fraud.
In fact, there's even been very few civil cases. Because the real test is, are my financial statements accurate? Not do I have internal controls? And in fact, one of the members of our advisory committee, made that point repeatedly to us, that you won't find people civilly liable to other parties for failure to have an adequate internal controls. In fact, what happens is you get an audit, the auditor issues the opinion on the financial statements, because what they do is they do additional testing or whatever is necessary to make sure that they feel comfortable with the financial statements, even though your internal controls aren't adequate.
That makes sense. Issues of causation might be interesting, among other things. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes to wrap up here, and I'm very interested in hearing each of you forecast where you think we'll be in 5 years with respect to Section 404 and the then state of the art.
Well, I'm not as sanguine that, it's going to cure all evils. I think we will have scandals from time to time, just because of, why rob banks? Because there's money there. Why have scandals? Because people take unfair advantage or illegal advantage. So I don't think it's going to stamp out everything. I think it has and will cause an improvement. I think people will learn to live with it. I think you will continue to see a lot of restatements for a variety of other reasons, not because of lack of internal control. But I guess on balance, it's here. We're going to have to live with it. And if it does provide additional investor confidence, I think that's a plus.
Very quickly, I think, as Herb says, this is really going to be part and parcel of the fabric of being a public company. It's going to be fully accepted. It's going to be predicate to being public. I think it's going to be modeled more closely in jurisdictions around the world, because there's going to be some significant accounting frauds ahead in a number of those markets. There's some pretty interesting challenges, though, that come up with this. The question is whether audit firms are going to be comfortable with an audit process that requires a scaled approach, given what they've come from. Will boards be actually able to put their foot down and sort of stand their ground in terms of what their risk judgments are and what their top-down judgments are for the internal control structure, and thinking that that's going to be adequate? So there's going to be some give and take on this effectiveness versus efficiency. And corporations want to be efficient in terms of cost. Audit firms will want to be effective in terms of the audit process, and that's going to be an interesting dynamic. The whole issue of SOX sort of plays into this theme that our organization continues to look at with respect to business and financial services integrity. And we hope to avoid situations like Sarbanes-Oxley, that industry is able to identify these problems beforehand so that you don't have heavy-handed formal regulation that has to be in place. Maybe that's wishful thinking. Maybe people will try to get away with whatever they can get away with until they can't. But we're optimistic that this is sort of a model for how not to do it in the future.
Kurt and Herb, thank you for your insightful comments and perspectives on why Sarbanes-Oxley, and especially Section 404, continue to stir up controversy. I do think it would be interesting to reprise this discussion in another 5 years to better judge the long-term effects of SOX. Will folks still be singing the blues, or might there be somewhat a more cheerful tune? More immediately, I would also like to thank ASECA, the Association of SEC Alumni, Inc., and Pfizer, Inc., for helping to make possible our 2007 Fireside Chat season. We broadcast discussions on Congress and the SEC, the courts and the SEC, insider trading, the accounting aspects of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and today's chat on Section 404. Today's Fireside Chat, along with previous chats from our 2004 through 2007 seasons, is now archived in audio format in the Virtual Museum, so you can listen again to the discussion at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the audio in MP3 format, will be accessioned in the online programs section in the coming months. This is the conclusion of our 2007 Fireside Chat season, but is not the end of the SEC Historical Society's online programs this year. Please plan to tune in to www.sechistorical.org on Thursday, November 1st at 12 noon Eastern Time to listen to Keeping the Markets Open, Lessons Learned for the 1987 Market Break, with Brandon Becker, Andrea Corcoran, SEC Chairman Christopher Cox, William Johnston, Richard Ketchum, David Reuter, and SEC Division of Market Regulation Director Eric Seary. Keeping the Markets Open is the first in a series of SEC Historical Society online programs to commemorate the upcoming 75th anniversary in 2009 of the founding of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. I'll return next spring for the 2008 Fireside Chat season, which will also help commemorate this anniversary, looking at the work of some of the major divisions and offices of the SEC. Please join me next March 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for our first Fireside Chat of 2008, looking at the Office of the General Counsel. My guests will be former General Counsels Daniel Geltzer and Giovanni Prezioso. Thank you again for being with us today.